Good morning. My name is Carolyn Carter. This is for History, Oral History, Professor Dr. Keith Finley. This is an interview with Mr. Otis Carter, United States Navy veteran. We will now start the interview. Mr. Carter, I want you to start the interview. You will start with introducing yourself.
My name is Otis Carter. I was born January 19th, 1926 in Detroit, Michigan to Lenora and Henry Carter. We lived on the west side of Detroit.
Tell me about growing up. What's your earliest memory?
My very earliest memory was on Sunday. We always went to Sunday school. And that was, to me, very, very enlightening because it was the first time that I was exposed to the Bible. And at that time, all children went to Sunday school. They didn't ask you whether you wanted to go to Sunday school. You automatically knew as soon as you woke up on Sunday, you were going to Sunday school.
What church did you attend?
Tabernacle Baptist Church on Beechwood and Milford.
Now tell me about your family life.
My family life? My father was a mechanic and he wasn't a very educated man, but he was a very smart man. Not only was he a master mechanic, he was an electrician and a carpenter combined. So where he didn't have a lot of education, he had a lot of mother wit to do just about anything. In fact, he was one of the very few men after the war that worked at Ford Motor Car Company and worked by himself because no one else could do what he did.
What did he do?
He worked on high-lows, and at the time nobody hardly knew anything at all about high-lows.
Did he get that skill in the armed forces? Did he get that skill in the armed forces?
No. I don't know where he just picked it up growing up as a youngster. As I said, he didn't have much education. As I remember, I have a certificate in my album where he graduated from Northwestern High School in the third grade. That's as far as he went in school.
How could he graduate at the third grade?
Well, he graduated from the third grade. That's all. They gave him a certificate for the third grade.
Now, where were your parents from?
My mother was from Cincinnati, Ohio. And my father was from Lexington, Kentucky. But I don't know much about my father or my mother, their history. Old people back in that day didn't talk about family history. In fact, they didn't do much talking about anything to children, period, at the time. And my father didn't talk to the children very much, his children, because he felt that he didn't have much of an education and there was very little he could tell them. But the whole thing in a nutshell, anything that he had to say was worth listening to.
Because he was articulate or because he knew the news that was going on during that time? What made him so interesting to listen to?
Well, he knew exactly what he was talking about. Although he couldn't put it on paper, he could tell you a lot of things. For instance, in 1946, 47, my brother started going to Wolverine Trade School, and that's when diesel, the automatic transmission first came in 1947. And my brother was asking my father about it. Well, my father couldn't put it on paper how it worked, but he could tell him how it worked because he knew everything that there was about an automobile. He could take a car and tear it apart and put it back together again. He was just that good. A master mechanic.
And he never went to school, got any education for that?
No, okay. Just something he picked up.
Okay. What branch of armed forces did he serve? What branch of armed services did he serve?
My father, he was in the Army for a very short period of time, World War I. A laborer, that's all they had, occupied as a laborer, that's all.
Tell me about your mother.
My mother? I know nothing at all about my mother. I can't tell you a single thing about her.
What are your memories of her?
My memories?
Yeah, what are your memories of her?
Taking us to Sunday school and always make sure that we were dressed nice to go to school and things like that.
What was her educational background?
I know nothing at all about her background. My mother or my father.
Okay.
They never told us a single thing.
What about your grandparents?
My grandparents? I don't remember grandparents. My grandparents were dead when I was born. When I was born, the only thing I had was my mother and father and my brothers and sisters.
Okay. Tell me about your siblings. Who are they? Their names.
Well, I had a half-brother, Walter King, and a sister, Arnita Evans, and then another brother, Henry Carter, and then there was Eleanor, and then there was Orville, and I was the last born.
So you were the youngest of the six? Of the six.
I was my mother's pride and joy.
Okay. So take me along now that you are a teenager. You're in high school now. So tell me about your school years.
I didn't get to high school. I was a very poor student. And that was one of the reasons when World War II started, I thought I would join the service. Now, in Detroit, you couldn't quit school until you were 16 years of age. I knew it was impossible for me to quit school, but when the war started, that was my chance to get away. And since I didn't excel in English or math, and as I said, I was a poor student, That was just my time to get away from Detroit.
So were you old enough to enlist in the Army?
No.
I mean, the Armed Forces?
The war started December 7th, 1941. I was 15 at the time. But because my sister was a secretary and worked downtown, I had her change my birth certificate. And I got my mother to sign for me. And that's when I went down and enlisted in the Navy. Well, at the time, the war had just started. They was taking anything that could breathe at the time, so they were glad to take me.
Did any of your friends go with you? You just went by yourself?
There were seven of us went down to enlist at the time, and out of the seven, I'm the only one that they took. Now, that's cold.
Why do you think that is? Did they have issues or they weren't old enough?
They were old enough, but I just looked, in my way of thinking, I looked the most promising, so they said that I'll take him. And left all the rest of them. The six other friends that I went down with, they didn't take any of them. I'm the only one that they took.
So what was that process like? You went down there, you filled out the paperwork to enlist. What happened next?
They told me to, after I filled out the paperwork, told me to go home, and in a few days, a few weeks, they would call me. And they did. I think it was in February of 42 that they said, okay, come on down. And then I went down to the federal building, and that's when I was sworn in. And that in itself was quite an experience.
How so?
For the simple reason, at the tender age of 16, I had never been away from home before.
But were you 16 or were you 15?
Well, this was February of 42. I had just turned 16.
Okay.
So then I went down to a federal building, and that's where I swore in. And then they put us on a train that sent us to the Norfolk Naval Base. And what was really an experience is I had no idea that I got on a luxury train in Detroit, and as soon as I got to Cincinnati, they took me out of the luxury car and put me in right behind the engine, smoke and dust and everything. And that's the way they did all the blacks back then. Took you out of segregated car and put you in a car for blacks only.
Wait, were there others with you?
No.
You were by yourself?
Yeah.
How did you feel? You had never left home, you had never traveled. How did you feel at 16?
It was an adventure. Something I had never experienced before. I got to Norfolk Naval Base, and it's a new experience for me.
So once you got to Norfolk, what happened next?
Well, we went to boot camp.
How was that?
This was a very segregated Navy. At the time, the United States government said black men didn't have enough brains, weren't courageous enough to do any fighting, so we gonna make them service troops, and that's all. And that's all blacks could do in the Navy, is we were officers, cooks, and stewards. Wait on officers. You didn't do any fighting at all during World War II. And I say all the time, ready? And I say all the time, black mothers in World War II should thank God that the government said that there's black people weren't smart enough to fight. When you see a picture of World War II, you see fighting and all going on, you don't see no black soldiers. All you ever see is white troops fighting and like that, because black troops didn't do any fighting in World War II. They were just service troops, unloading ships and things like that. And they had a movie came out called The Red Ball Express. You ever heard of it? Red Ball Express. It showed, I forgot the name of the star that made the movie Red Ball Express. Red Ball Express wasn't whites. It was all black outfit. They're the ones that took all the gasoline and ammunition to Patton's troops during the fighting. And Patton said himself during the war, if it wasn't for the Red Ball Express, we never would have won the war.
Red Ball Express were Army officers or Navy officers?
Red Ball Express was Army. Army truck drivers. And they loaded up gasoline and ammunition and took it up to the fighting front. And they weren't white, they were all black.
So now you're in this Army, you're in Norfolk, Virginia.
Navy,
I'm sorry. You're in Norfolk, Virginia. How long did you stay in Norfolk?
I was in boot camp, I think about 2 months.
Okay.
And the funny part about in boot camp, they gave us a rifle and a bayonet, but the only thing, we never did have any training how to shoot a rifle or use a bayonet, so I don't know what the heck they gave it to us for.
So you never used it?
No. No.
So you left Norfolk, Virginia in 2 months, and you went where?
Well, now that's the thing that I think was pretty lousy. Most service men, when you complete your basic training, they send you home for a few days, and then they assign you to wherever you're going. My outfit, as soon as we got out of boot camp, they put us on a train, shipped us to California, and sent us straight overseas. And that's one of the things that I did not particularly like. I'm one of the few servicemen in time of war who went AWOL for the simple reason I was sick and tired of being overseas. They had a thing in World War II that said, if you do 18 months overseas, they'll rehabilitate you and send you home. Well, I did 18 months overseas, did another 18 months overseas, did another 18 months overseas. I left home at 16. By the time I decided I got sick and tired of being overseas, I was darn near 20. It was November, and I was almost 20. So I decided to go AWOL, to go over the hill. But I had enough sense in wartime to know that I didn't want to get charged with desertion. So I went, after being AWOL for 6 days, I went and turned myself into the shore patrol, which is the police, and they said, we don't have a record of you. Said, wherever you were, gone back. And I had a girlfriend over there then that I'd been with going for 3 years. So I went back to her house, and after six more days, I went back to the shore patrol, and they said, we want you. And that's when they decided to lock me up and send me back to my ship.
So they put you in jail?
In the brig, yeah. And that was a horrible experience for the simple reason. It was December at the time that I went in the brig. It was the hottest month of the year in Australia. You know, Australia is down under the equator. So December is hot as hell. July and August is cold as hell. Well, when I went in the brig was infested with bed bugs. And what happened, you'd go to bed at night and turn off the light and count to five, and when you turn off the light, you could see your pillow moving, so many bed bugs was crawling on the pillow. Well, as it wound up, it was so hot. And so in December, we walked around with just your skivvies on and no shoes or socks. And I was walking around in stagnant water, and I wound up, my feet got infected. I got blood poisoning. And that's when they had to put me in the hospital. And that wasn't too pleasant, because at night my feet would bleed and pus would run out of them. And in the morning they'd have to come in and crack my toes open, which didn't feel too good. So I stayed in the hospital, I think, for about a month or so. And then they sent me back aboard ship.
Tell me about your experiences on the ship. What did you do on the ship? What did you do on the ship?
Stewards mate. That's all blacks did in the Navy back at that time. They hadn't integrated the Navy where blacks could be taken in as seamen or anything like that. So I was officers, cook, and the stewards. Wait on officers. Clean the staterooms and things like that.
So you were basically housekeeping for the Navy.
That's all it was. a housekeeper, a servant.
So you were there, so you never saw any action of any kind. You were just on the ship.
No. The ship I was on was a destroyer tender, was a repair ship. So all we did was repair other ships that went into battle and got hit, and then come back and repair them. The only time that I enjoyed in the Navy is when we'd go down to Australia and New Zealand, and we did that once a year, and that was wonderful.
And why was it so wonderful?
Beg pardon?
Why was it so wonderful?
For the simple reason that white women thought that black men were the greatest thing in the world. Now, here's the difference between black servicemen and white servicemen. The white man always thought that he was a conquering hero, and wherever he go, he rule, and things like that. Blacks went in with the idea just to get along. I can always remember there was a rule that the ruling general, army general in Australia, put out a rule that said, like Woodward Avenue separates east side and west side, the American general said all blacks had to stay on the west side of Woodward. The whites could go anywhere they wanted to go. And the Australian Attorney General of Australia told the American general, go stuff yourself. Blacks can go anywhere they want to go. Well, that led to what we call the Battle of Brisbane. Do you remember me telling you that some Australian newspaper reporters came to Detroit and interviewed black servicemen in Australia? Well, they came over here and interviewed us. I gave your son a record of that.
I'll have to find it. So tell me about this person that you was seeing over there for four years, five years, six years. Was she Australian? Who was this person?
Her name was Eileen. I can remember the first liberty that I had. Now, I'm 16. I didn't drink, I didn't smoke, and my knowledge of women was very limited. I didn't know nothing about women. I had my little escapades with girls, and I wasn't a virgin at the time. But I remember that first night I went to the club, and Eileen was there, and we were at the club, and I said, I didn't drink, I didn't smoke, and at the end of the night, the bartender said, last call for alcohol. And I looked at Eileen, and she looked at me. She said, I'm taking you home with me. And I wondered, well, if I'm going home, I said, oh my goodness, what am I supposed to do? It didn't take me long. Here's another thing that I liked about the Australian women that was so different than American women. When you met an Australian woman, at the end of the night, she took you home with her. Her parents were glad to see you and things like that. You got along fine. In America, when you met a girl the first night, she didn't take you home with her. In Australia, they did. There was no doubt in your mind what was going to be like.
So were you expecting to marry this girl? Were you expecting to marry her?
No.
So that wasn't the expectation?
No. But what made it so nice, at 16, I had a mother, a sweetheart, a lover, a teacher, all rolled into one. Everything. Everything that I didn't know, she taught me. And she had a whole lot to teach.
So, I mean, after you left the armed forces, did you ever think about, did you keep in contact with her?
Not really, but she wrote to my mother while we were together.
So now, when did you leave the armed forces, the Navy?
November of 1945.
And so you came back where?
December, came home.
Came back to Detroit.
Yeah.
And then, what was the climate like in Detroit for from people who served in the armed forces?
Well, put it this way, I came home in November of 1945, and a Class A uniform had a ribbon on, a couple of stars. I got off at the train station, Michigan Central train station, which was quite fabulous at the time, stood outside trying to catch a cab. Not one single cab would pick me up. No white cab picked up a black serviceman during World War II. I had to wait for a little black cab to come along and pick me up in order to take me home. Now, Detroit was very segregated during the war and after the war. The only difference between Detroit and Mississippi was that they didn't call you no nigger down here because they know they'd get the stew beat out of it. But in Detroit, in 1946, when I was a young man, you did not go to any bars on Woodward Avenue. You couldn't go to Hudson's and shop. You didn't eat in any restaurants downtown. It was just like being in the South. Except that they said you didn't have to ride on the back of the bus. That was the only difference. Detroit was very segregated at the time.
Did your parents know you were coming home? Did your parents know you were coming home?
No, my mother didn't know that I was coming home. In fact, no, I didn't tell them I was coming home. And that's the funny part about it. When I came home, my mother was in Cincinnati. And my father was really surprised to see me. And so he hugged me and welcomed me home. And I said, where's my mother? And she said, he told me she's in Ohio. Well, now here I am, a young man, I'm home, and I'm not gonna sit around the house. They didn't have television back then. So I went out to the Bluebird Inn at the time. And I'm sitting there. Well, being a serviceman, you didn't have to pay for your drinks or anything like that. People bought you drinks and things like that. And I can remember at 2 o'clock, the lady said to me, the bartender said, again, said, same thing, like last call for alcohol. And the lady I was talking to, she said, hi, Papa. She said, what do you want to do? I said, let's go to the slaughterhouse.
What was the slaughterhouse?
Hotel.
That was the name of it?
Well, that's what we call it, the slaughterhouse. So we went to the hotel.
Where was that located?
The hotel? On Warren Avenue. It was called a Tourist Inn. And after we went to the Tourist Inn, the next day I went home. I got home about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and my mother was there, and she was baking a cake, and she said, do you know that you've been out all night long? And I said, yes. And she said, where have you been? I said, I was out making my liver quiver. And she turned around, hit me right in the mouth with the baking spoon, the spoon that she was making the cake with. And I was really shocked. Here I am, a grown man in uniform, and she got the nerve to hit me in the mouth. I guess she said, you still my child.
So now you're home, you've served in the war, you're in your 20s. Could you find a job? What did you do?
Jobs, you could get a job anywhere at the time. Anywhere you could get a job. I think the first job I had, I worked at DeSoto. Yeah, DeSoto right down the street from where I live. And by that time, I know, like this sign that says, during the war, Uncle Sam points a finger and says, I want you. There was a girl who lived down the street from me, four doors down, by the name of Dorothy Carter, Dorothy Jones. And she looked at me and said, I want him, and decided, that's who I'm gonna marry.
So how did that relationship quickly take me through that courtship?
Well, first of all, this is the thing about it that was not very cool. I was 20 and she was 16. Well, nowadays there's a law. A 20-year-old man fool around with a 16-year-old girl, they'll put you in jail. Well, at the time, I don't guess her folks thought too much about it. But here's another thing that wasn't too good. All of her people, her father was a college professor. He was a college graduate. Her sister was in law school. Her brother-in-law and sister-in-law all were college people. And I had never even got out of high school. So this wasn't the greatest thing in the world. They weren't too thrilled about this at the time.
She was determined, obviously.
Oh yeah, she was determined. She was determined.
So you guys met, you got together, you got married. You got married.
Well, what happened, her mother had enough sense to realize that her daughter was so much in love with this hot papa that she didn't want her daughter to get pregnant. So she thought it would be a smart idea, take us to Ohio and we would get married. So we went to Ohio, her mother and Dorothy and I went to Ohio, and unbeknownst to anybody else, we wound up getting married. Well, my mother and them wasn't too pleased about it. When it came back, well, they didn't know it because we didn't tell them. So we were married, and I went home at night. I went home during the day, and she went home just four doors down and went to school every day. And all was well, 8, 9, 10 months. And then one day she came to me and said, I got something to tell you. When she said, I got something to tell you, I thought she could probably tell me I want a new pair of shoes or something like that. And she told me instead, she said, we gonna have a baby. And I said, what, we gonna have a baby? I didn't have the faintest idea what she was talking about. She said, I'm pregnant. Well, by when she told me she was pregnant, all hell broke loose because my mother had and sister in 1946 were planning on buying us, giving us a wedding present, a brand new refrigerator and a stove. That's a hell of a wedding present. So we had to tell everybody we were married. And her father wasn't too happy about it at the time. And I remember I left home, all I had was a pillowcase with my belongings in it, and went down four doors down to her brother's house, and that's where we started housekeeping right then and there.
So you guys stayed there until the first child was born? You lived with them until the first child was born?
Right, the first child, Pamela, was born. My love of my life, Pamela, the first child was born. And at the time, I was working at DeSoto. That was okay job. But I thought I wanted a little more protection now that I had started a family. So that's when I decided to get a job at the post office. And then that's when I started working at the post office, Strathmore Station.
How long did you work at the post office?
I think I did about 7 years at the post office.
Okay. So after you left, how did you end up at Ford Motor Company?
Well, at the time, wait a minute, I left the post office because my brother-in-law was working for board education at the time, and I decided I'd rather get a job at the board. So then I got a job at the board education working at Durfee Junior High. And the way I got started working at Ford is my brother-in-law was instrumental in getting young men jobs at Ford. Well, for the board, you only work 10 months a year, and you could work that summer or take off that summer. So I thought I'd go and give Ford a shot.
What did you do at the board? What did you do for
what you call a locker attendant?
Okay.
A locker room where the kids came in and took showers and things like that. So when I got the job at Ford, I'll never forget the first week at Ford's. Now I had been working for the board for 11 years at the time I got the job at Ford. My first paycheck with Ford's was more than I made after working 11 years at the board. So I said, the hell with it, I'm gonna stay at Ford for a while. That's when I decided I'm working, I got a family now, and I've got 7 children. I worked at 2 jobs. I worked for the Board of Education and Ford Motor Car Company 11 straight years. That's a long time to work 2 jobs. I get, when we go to Ford's at 11 o'clock at night, get off and at 7, leave there, go straight to the school and work there from 8 to 4. And then go home and sleep from 4 to 11. And I did that for 11 years. That's a long time to work 2 jobs.
So now you're at, well, did you guys have your own place? Your own?
Oh yeah. By that time we had bought a house and things like that.
So you're at Ford.
And trying to raise 7 children.
So what did you do at Ford?
I was what you call a chip puller. A machine would cut parts out, and it would fill up a gondola full of chips. And I was a truck driver. And I would drive around and pick up the chips and then take them down to the railroad car and dump the chips and then bring it back and put it back on the machine. So I was, what you call a chip puller.
How many years did you work at Ford? How many years at Ford?
30.
And you did that for 30 years? That same job?
Yeah.
Through the railroad. So now you're working at Ford, you're a chip builder. Tell me about the climate at Ford Motor Company. What was it like working there through the years? What was the camaraderie with the employees? How did you, in terms of the unions and the employees, tell me about the climate at Ford.
The climate at Ford, I worked at Livonia Transmission. And the climate wasn't very cool for the simple reason that when I was hired there, the only thing that worked at Livonia was hillbillies. And they had that hillbilly mentality. And the whites were the only ones that had really good jobs there. And when we came out there and we tried to move in on the jobs, the whites didn't exactly like that. And I can remember when I was working there, that's when they started bringing the Arabs in and bringing the women in. And that was a disaster. The Arabs and bringing women into the plant was a disaster, period. For the simple reason that the Arabs thought that they were better than you and they wanted the best jobs. And because the women were cut different from you, the foreman gave the women the good jobs. And at night, they would go out in the trucks and take care of the foreman out there. So that made it kind of bad. But it was very prejudiced out there.
Now, what plant were you?
Livonia Transmission.
So you were there the whole 30 years?
Yeah.
Okay. What?
It got better at the end.
When you say got better at the end, what do you mean?
After I was there about 20 years or so, things got better. You could get any kind of job you wanted. You were qualified. I mean, there wasn't as prejudice then.
What time of the year was that? In the 70s, 80s?
Say about 70, 76,
okay. 75. Had you imagined that your life would take you, after serving in the Navy, serving on that ship, traveling to Australia, had you imagined that your life would take you to a life of being in the automotive industry? Or did you think that that's where you would end up because of your educational background?
Well, I thought because of my education, that's what I'd wind up. But then again, those were some of the best jobs that men had in Detroit at the time. Men who worked at the factory made more money than just about anybody there. Made more money than school teachers and lawyers and everybody else. We were the top dogs back then. I can remember that on church, like men wear diamond stick pins, you had a Ford badge, you wore your Ford badge on your suit, just like you wore a diamond stick pin. That was a prestige job back then.
So what would you say about your experience of serving in the Navy?
It more or less, as I said, was an adventure. I got a chance to go places that I'd never been before. For instance, I remember when I had a 48-hour pass in Australia, I got on a train one time and rode as far as this train would go. And people there had never seen a black man before.
What advice would you give to maybe one of your grandchildren who wanted to serve in the armed forces today? What would you tell them?
First thing I would tell them is get an education first. The service doesn't want any dummies anymore. That time of like World War II, where they had service troops, where they dug ditches and latrines and things like that, that's all over with now. Nowadays, you have to have a technical knowledge of what's going on. You have to use a computer and be able to at least use a computer, be able to read and write.
Have you ever used a computer?
No.
Do you regret that? Do you regret that?
Yes and no. I regret it for the simple reason it has a lot of knowledge on there. But then again, I look at it this way. I'm content to read and watch television. That's good enough for me at my age now.
So you spend your days reading now? How much
that's
do you
right.
read?
That's right. Very little television.
How much do you read? A novel a week, a novel a day?
Book like that, 2 days. I get 20 to 25 books a month. at the end of that month, I've read all of it. It'll take me 2 days to read this book. I would rather read a good book than turn on that garbage on the TV. For instance, I don't turn television on until 4 o'clock. I watch Judge Judy. And then after Judge Judy, I watch the news until 6 o'clock. And then I'll turn it off and don't turn it on again until 8 o'clock to watch Bill O'Reilly, to see what Bill O'Reilly's got to say about what's going on in the world.
When we started this interview, you said one of the Navy themes was full speed ahead, 30 Burke.
Do what?
One of the themes that you said for the Navy was full speed ahead, yeah. 31 knot Burke.
Yeah, 31 knot Burke.
What does that mean?
During World War II, there was a decisive battle going on with the Japanese fleet. And we were outnumbered, and at the time, about the only thing that they had, that American forces had, was a lot of destroyers. And Burke was in charge of these. He wasn't an admiral at the time. He was in charge of these destroyers. And a destroyer was fighting a much larger ship, and they knew that they didn't stand a chance fighting a large ship unless they outmaneuvered him. So that's when he said, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead, and do all the maneuvering you can to sink these ships. And that was the famous last words as far as World War II was concerned. Damn the torpedoes and full speed ahead. And they won the battle.
Thank you for your interview.